This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. We're marking the one-year anniversary of Hurricane Irma's arrival in southwest Florida today. Later this hour, we'll get an update from Corkscrew Swamp Sanctuary about how the storm affected the plants and animals that call it home and how rebuilding efforts have gone there. We'll sit down with a professional home watcher to discuss how Irma has changed her business. But first, an update from the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Hurricane Florence has rapidly intensified into a major Category 4 storm today. And in the words of the National Hurricane Center, it's likely to be a large and dangerous threat to portions of North and South Carolina. While Florence is not a direct threat to Florida, meteorologist Jeff Huffman urges residents along the Atlantic coast to use caution near the water this week.
Even though Florence will be hundreds of miles away from Florida, it's expected to grow in size dramatically by midweek. This will send large ocean swells and a high ripcurrent risk to all beaches. Boaters and mariners will probably also encounter some rough seas through the weekend. And at times of high tide, coastal flooding and beach erosion is a concern, especially north of Cape Canaveral.
Huffman says he's also watching Hurricane Isaac and another disturbance in the Gulf of Mexico, but neither are presently a threat to the state of Florida. Here in southwest Florida, we're marking the one-year anniversary of Hurricane Irma making landfall by taking a look at two of the hardest-hit spots. First, Everglades City took the brunt of the much-anticipated storm surge. Everything in that town that was on the ground was flooded, and almost everything in town had some sort of damage. Late last week, I took a drive down through Chokoloskee, Plantation Islands, and Everglades City, and here's that story. The Island Cafe sits on the main road into Everglades City. It's where tourists try out gator bites, but the locals go for the cheeseburgers. And on this day, a year after Hurricane Irma deposited almost a foot of sludge on the floor, it's cleaned up and bustling with customers. For this town of just over 400 people, it's been 12 months of hard work, waiting, and learning, especially for Mayor Howie Grimm, who was appointed mayor just 5 days before the storm hit.
I didn't know anything about government. You know, I'm used to being in business and things happen really quick. And with the government, it doesn't happen that fast. So that's been the biggest learning thing for me is patience.
Grimm says 8,500 volunteers flooded the town in the 2 months after the hurricane and discovered a place they wanted to return to. And that helped the town through what might have been a horrible tourist season.
So when season started, a lot of those same people came back. I met some of them in our retail market that said, we just wanted to come back and help. We wanted to spend money in Everglades City to help you recover.
Almost all the homes and businesses in Everglades City were badly damaged or destroyed. And there was one Hurricane Irma-related death. Lee Martini, the Everglades fixture everyone in town seemed to know, died from a bacterial infection days after fighting through chest-high floodwaters, escaping his home during the brunt of the storm. His wife, Lisa Martini, was by his side that day, and still works in City Hall, where she does water billing.
It seems like forever ago that we had the storm, but I can sit at the breakfast table in my mind, and, you know, Lee's right there. So, yeah, nothing has changed, you know what I mean, in a sweet way. The memories are just so vivid for me.
The Martini home stood until just days ago.
The memories that come up with the house is that I just kept seeing what it used to be. You know, I would see Lee everywhere. And, you know, so those memories. But then there wasn't any way to rebuild. It was utterly, totally ruined.
Like many others in Everglades City, Martini has been displaced. She stayed with friends or in a FEMA trailer while waiting on grants, FEMA money, and insurance money.
Insurance money is slower than FEMA. I mean, you had to hire somebody to fight for your own money. You know, it's kind of ridiculous. Our city clerk, Dottie, just got her insurance money just a couple of weeks ago. I mean, we're almost a year out, and she had to literally fight for it.
But Grimm says slowing down the rebuilding process has forced some long-range planning on the part of those wanting to rebuild.
We've got about 25 homes on the ground right now that we're waiting, that haven't been worked on at all, that we're waiting on grant money to raise them, to elevate them, and then fix them. We just hate to see people put a bunch of money in a home that's on the ground, and then it happens again, because it's not if we have another hurricane. We understand we're going to have another one.
For Lisa Martini, the slow recovery pace has helped her through a difficult year of new beginnings and treasured memories.
The treasures are in my heart. It's, you know, where no moth and no rust can get, because and that's what's important. I thank God every day that I had Lee Martini in my world for as long as I did. And I didn't want to miss a molecule of this past year, because for me it was a sacred time. I wanted to honor my love for him.
If you drive through the streets of Everglades City, the homes look good from the outside, but the ones with the windows wide open give a telltale sign that the interior isn't fixed yet. Almost all of the restaurants are open, and at Island Cafe, there are only a couple of T-shirts indicating the wearer is a volunteer, still helping to rebuild. And we'd like to know if you have any Hurricane Irma stories you'd like to share with us today. We'd love to hear from you. Give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Or you can catch us on social media. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCO. Another hard hit part of Southwest Florida was Immokalee. While they sit a bit inland from the coastal village of Everglades City, the storm howled through the town. That's home to a number of farm workers and their families. WGCU's Rachel Iacovone was there this weekend and found that the famously tight-knit community is what helped move repairs along.
Lisa Castaneda lives with her mother in Immokalee. The young woman is bilingual, but when I meet them both, I ask my questions in Spanish so her mom, Saida, can tell me about La Tormenta, too. How was your house afterward? I begin.
¿Cómo estuvo tu casa después?
Se llenó de agua por la the lake, por la laguna. Mucho de las chingas, the shingles. Se callaron, so eso afectó nuestro roof,
el techo.
Lisa tells me their home along Lake Trafford filled with water. Most of the shingles fell off the roof. El techo, her mother corrects. So, did you tell anyone? I ask. FEMA?
¿Le dijiste a alguien? FEMA?
Sí, la avisamos, pero...
Yes, we told them, but... Saida cuts in. They took too long, she says.
Tardaron mucho para arreglarlos o que nosotros la arreglamos
sí,
personalmente.
Yeah.
So they fixed the damage themselves. Lisa's a communication student at Florida Gulf Coast University. Her mom is a farm worker who usually works in the orange fields. So they found the disaster aid within their tight-knit community for cheaper and faster. Across town, Mass lets out at Our Lady of Guadalupe Catholic Church. Hungry parishioners line up for the homemade tacos around back, where Irene Barnhart Sauceda is manning the outdoor grill.
We were out of power for 17 days. I think we were the last group to get power in Immokalee.
Barnhart Sauceda, her husband, and their three boys live on the inland-most edge of town, so they never got the break of the eye passing over, just the eye wall for the entirety of the slow-moving storm's landfall.
It took off our pool cage, our lanai. We had flood damage in our barn, our sheds, our other rooms.
The family's repairs are beginning with a pool cage, a year later, on the very day Irma tore it from their home.
We've been waiting and waiting. There's just too many people that needed repairs.
Despite the wait, Barnhart Sauceda says she feels blessed that it wasn't worse. She tells me what many in Immokalee have since Irma. Thank God. Gracias a Dios. Rachel Iacovone, WGCU News, Immokalee.
And Rachel's in the studio with us now to talk a little bit more about the weekend that you spent out there in Immokalee. Rachel, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Julie.
It's great to have you. So tell me, what took you out to Immokalee this weekend? Was there something going on?
Yeah, so I was actually following up with a segment we'd done on Gulf Coast Live earlier. It's a study for FGCU, and it was expanded, actually. When we talked about it originally, it's a study on Latino health, and now it's also providing health care for them. Just, you know, little things like blood pressure that they might not have access to.
Those kinds of screening things, right? And then I remember that they were doing a survey to try to get a feeling for how the people in Immokalee feel about their health care options and status or how they view their own health. And I understand that they're adding a question about how they feel Hurricane Irma has impacted their health.
Yeah. So the interesting part before was it was a door-to-door thing where they would knock on your door and say, hi, what do you know about your health? And then kind of correct, you know, some wrong answers people might have.
Like they feel like they're terribly fit, but then they're not?
Yeah.
That kind of stuff?
The things that they don't know, I'm asking them, like, what's the difference between a heart attack and a brain aneurysm? And people think those are similar, apparently, or a stroke. So those types of situations that maybe you don't know the signs of if you are in that community. So they were educating them on the spot. However, they couldn't really quantify how much they were really retaining that information. So with this one, now they're doing those little screenings. And then afterward, there's an optional training. And most people went to it. And it was maybe 15 minutes tops. And in that training, they've added a portion that is hurricane specific or emergency specific, where not only does it include the health aspects of these are the things you need to keep in mind if another disaster happens, but also these are the sources you should go to. So like public radio was mentioned in it. It's saying don't trust Facebook because you might end up on a back road and then stuck.
Or you might end up getting some false information. Yeah,
exactly.
Trusted sources always are important. Mm-hmm. So you're going to do a longer story about that health survey in the future. So I'm looking forward to hearing that. But as far as how you saw people recovering from Hurricane Irma a year later, what I found most striking out of the story that we just heard was it seems like that the area there is famous for being a tight-knit community where people kind of take care of one another. And it seems like that really helped after the storm went through, where people were able to resource some people to help, you know, fix roofs, for example, like they were talking about. Did you see that that community thing really had a pretty big impact over there?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I've seen this before, too, being from this area. It was the same thing after Hurricane Wilma. That didn't hit much of the coast in that case. That storm had really hit, like, inland Colliers. That they got the brunt of that in Immokalee. So a lot of people talked about their experience with that storm versus this storm. And so they kind of knew what to expect. But some of them, their children were not even around for it. So they expected, okay, we need to do this, this, and this. However, some people were farm workers who were in a different area of Florida for that one. So they didn't experience a storm, or they haven't experienced a storm since Andrew. And exactly. So they relied on the community knowledge. So going to their neighbors who knew what to do and how to board up windows and how much food and water to have in their homes really helped.
I'm wondering if a lot of people evacuated. Did you hear much about people who evacuated versus who didn't evacuate?
Most people I spoke to said they were there. After the church service lets out, you know, there's a big collection of them after Mass. And I'm just like, hey, who here was here for Irma? And it's kind of like
everyone.
A bunch of people was raising their hand. Like, of course I was here. You know, where else do I have to go?
Does it seem like evacuating isn't really as much of an option?
It isn't because, of course, there is already – that's why they're not seeking aid oftentimes is the fear if you are undocumented or someone in your family is even undocumented. So you don't want to be reaching out to FEMA when there is a fear being in a county that's part of a 287G program, which works with ICE, that – this could out me or my family or my friends or community.
I think it's really interesting. And that was my next question I was going to ask you, if there had been a number of people there that might be trying to fly under the radar and may not have reached out and asked for help that was actually available to everyone. And if you heard a lot about people who just kind of relied on friends and family instead of going to the authorities to get the assistance they might need. And is there any way to even quantify that?
That's the hard part. And I actually talked to one of the doctors in charge of the FGCU study to see if she'd heard anything as well, since I was there for the 2 days. And we've obviously visited Immokalee over the year, and I've heard that before this year for many years. And I asked, in your experience, what have they been saying to you? And she says, I would love to put numbers behind that, but how do you report when people are trying to fly under the radar and they're doing it well? How do you quantify how many are actually doing it? And when you're talking to people, their personal stories really add up to that. So I'm not going to say majority of town, but there is a large population in town that is getting by relying on their neighbors and everyone just kind of coming together and helping each other, because it's a win-win situation for everyone involved.
It's heartening, but it's also tough, you know? But
yeah.
It's a great story you've been covering for the full year.
Yeah.
Definitely. I really appreciate it. Thanks so much, Rachel, for being on the air all through the storm last year, 1 year ago, and then coming in again today to talk about Immokalee's recovery. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Hurricane Irma's high winds and storm surge caused massive property damage across southwest Florida. It caused a lot of headaches for the people who live here, but it also impacted the region's flora and fauna, including at Corkscrew Swamp Sanctuary in Collier County. WGCU's Mike and Irie caught up with its director, Jason Lauridsen, to reflect on how they weathered the storm and the ways it affected life at the sanctuary.
When Hurricane Irma hit Corkscrew Swamp Sanctuary last year, it had some immediate and obvious impacts. The first of those was the wind. The wind stress hit our cypress and our pine trees, basically defoliating our cypress forest. And that was an obvious indirect impact. It knocked a number of pines and cypress over as well. So you could see that immediate damage done by the high winds associated with Irma. Now, a lot of rain also came with that, so our water levels rose considerably as a result. We were about 10 inches above our average peak water level for the season following Irma. Water wasn't over our boardwalk, but it was over many of our backcountry roads. It caused some damage to some of our road infrastructure as a result of the high waters and the heavy flows. But it was that wind that was the most obvious and evident result there.
Were there any really big, what you might think of as a landmark tree knocked down?
Yes, we've identified 12 trees around our boardwalk that we've named and posted signs and reflect on the history of conservation in Florida and across the U.S. We know of those as our landmark cypress, and we lost two of our landmark cypress trees as a result of the hurricane. One of those was the Da Vinci tree, one of my favorites. It was a very aesthetically interesting tree because of the beautiful latticework of strangler fig that wove around this big old cypress tree. And because of that strangler fig, it was more susceptible to being impacted by winds, and that all that extra biomass that tree was holding up caused it to topple. So that's normal. Some of these trees are well over 500 years old, some 600-year-old trees, and a hurricane comes through and impacts the sanctuary on average every 14 years. So these trees have dealt with 30 or 40 hurricane events, and it's not uncommon for a big storm like that to drop one or two of the big trees.
Are those big trees still laying there, or are you able to get them out of there? What happens to them?
Well, one big tree fell right across the boardwalk and broke through the boardwalk deck. There were several locations where trees fell across the boardwalk and broke all the way through the decking. And we had to cut and remove the sections that fell over the boardwalk and rebuild the boardwalk in between there. But if they fall and they're not landing on the boardwalk, we leave them there. And those big tree trunks become nursery logs for the next generation of cypress trees or ferns or a red maple. In some cases, we have a royal palm that's growing out in the middle of our old growth bald cypress thanks to the nursery logs. They become great habitat for future forest diversity. There are still nursery logs visible at Corkscrew from the boardwalk that fell during Hurricane Donna in 1960. So you have these artifacts from these former storms that, again, 40, 50 years on, you're still seeing the impacts of those storms.
What do the animals do when a hurricane comes through? Were there wood storks there in September when Irma hit? And besides the wood storks, just other animals?
Yeah. The biggest impact from a storm event like Irma, I should say the most evident and obvious impact, comes to the cavity nesting birds. You're losing older, stressed, trees with great character that often have these cavities in them. So your owls, some of your cavity nesting ducks, your wood ducks and your black-bellied whistling ducks, woodpeckers, flickers, nuthatches, these birds that nest in cavities do end up getting displaced at times. And we did have a barred owl. It was a great horned owl that we think was a casualty of having being displaced that we saw kind of dazed in the area for a couple of days after that. And we saw some other cavity nesters come in. I rode out the storm in the Blair Audubon Center with a number of other staff and some volunteers. And we did have some cavity nesting birds that come in that we believe were displaced from the storm. Just during the storm, they showed up on the back porch, probably looking for shelter. So that's the most obvious. Some of the other animal impacts we know less about, and it's hard to nail down what the actual impact was. But what I found out months after the storm came from citizen science. We have these great volunteers and that participate in our citizen science activities, and we had this group show up and say, we haven't seen any zebra longwing butterflies at Corkscrew since the storm, and it had been maybe 4 or 5 months. And I still haven't seen a zebra longwing at Corkscrew a year out. So there are some other impacts that we think are related to those high winds, where the eggs or the pupa of these butterflies and moths are impacted, and tracking that is difficult. Now, there are zebra longwings in southwest Florida, so the population's not totally extirpated, but they have not made their way back in any numbers to Corkscrew. So we're still feeling some of those animal effects.
Are there any, ecological upsides to a hurricane? You did sort of mention, big trees get knocked over, that provides habitat, but are there any other, bonus aspects to a big storm like this when it comes to a place like Corkscrew?
That's a good question. What are the positives? What are the upsides? I am certain that there are winners as well as losers when you have these big disturbance events, whether it's flooding, whether it's high winds, whether it's fire. Certainly for a period of time, you have areas of our pine flatwoods where the wind didn't knock the trees over, but the pines became incredibly wind stressed. And as a result of that wind stress, some pine borer beetles have come in, and ultimately the trees have died. So you have these pine trees that are dead. So that if you're a woodpecker or a flicker or a cavity nesting bird, what you have is a new source of food out there. So that increased number of snags replaces some of those old snags. So there's some turnover there, and I'm sure for certain species that's considered a big benefit. One other thing is you're having a tremendous reduction in leaf cover for your forest. So light's getting to the forest floor, and certain species are taking advantage of that. Certain plant species take advantage of that new exposure to light. So there certainly are some winners. The biggest winner was a result of the high rains. With all that water in the system, with all of the sheet flow going on, what happened is you had this masking of our wetland losses. Now, everybody in Southwest Florida is probably aware of the hardship caused in the local communities. You had East Bonita, tremendous amounts of flooding and terrible hardship to the communities there. That's a result of the loss of these shallow wetlands. So many of our wetlands have been converted into other land uses. So when you have these big events like Irma, you get flooding in these areas, and that's a hardship to the people. But what it does is it also pushes the fish and other aquatic organisms out into these other areas, and these other areas serve as wetlands, the wetlands that we lost. So that's masked. So I guess a shorter answer to your question, who benefits? Wading birds benefited from Irma because all of these prey resources get pushed out into habitats that are usually fragmented.
Hmm.
And when the water levels drop, you have this prey available for foraging, for ibis, for herons, for egrets, for wood storks, for spoonbills. And it resulted in the earliest nest initiation at Corkscrew for the wood stork colony that we've seen in maybe 20 years. Which is good. It's good for a number of reasons, but that's more like their historic nest timing. They usually would nest in November or December, and this past year, they nested in mid-December, and that meant those chicks fledge earlier in the year, and there's higher success. So,
How are the wood storks doing this year, like right now?
We've had wood storks visible in our backcountry, a lot of juvenile wood storks, not breeding age, visible in our backcountry all year long, which is unusual. So for whatever reason, some of them have stuck around, and you see them still foraging, even though it's the middle of the rainy season, which is, again, unusual. Normally, they would be up north feeding in North Florida, Georgia, and South Carolina. So they're still here, and we've had relatively average water levels this rainy season, so you didn't get those any flooding events that would connect the fish to those isolated, fragmented wetland habitats. So I'm not expecting early nesting and a really fantastic wood stork season as a result of water levels. However, because of the success of last year, in 3 to 4 more years, we should have more fledglings that are at breeding age, and you might see another bump as a result of this past good year in a couple more years.
You know, corkscrews, you guys are known for your giant, super big orchid out there, the ghost orchid.
Yeah.
You know, it presumably made it. I saw a picture on the website that says it's blooming now. Did it suffer any damage? Do you remember, you know, there must have been a moment after the storm where you guys thought, well, let's go see if it's still there, right?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's not easy to see when it's not in bloom, but we all know where it is, all the staff here, all the volunteers. That was a neat story. After the hurricane, we got calls and emails from people across the country, some in other countries, asking about our ghost orchid, our super ghost, wondering if it made it, and it did. That super ghost survived the storm just fine and is blooming prolifically this summer. We did lose one ghost orchid. We had another ghost orchid on the Calusa tree, which is one of our landmark trees, and that orchid didn't make it through the storm. So it's hit or miss. We keep our eye on those charismatic orchids and definitely love to know that people care about them.
Are you guys, I guess, as prepared as you can be during, you know, we're in the peak of season now. You guys are ready in case something happens?
We are still, believe it or not, we are still rebuilding some sections of the boardwalk as a result of Irma. There were some portions that were badly damaged that were in deep areas that we didn't start the rebuilding until water levels were low in May. And so we're still working on some sections. We're hoping that by late October, we will have all of those repairs done and people will get to come and visit and see some of the new sections. We're testing out some new materials in that deep cypress area that will make our boardwalk more sustainable and hopefully something that we can continue to be leaders in, being a sustainable and green environmental organization.
All right. Any final thoughts?
I did want to share one other little anecdote here with you just about
sure.
the mystery of storms. Humans tend to try to dampen the peaks and valleys and the extremes of any climate or weather-related phenomenon. And you know, flooding and winds, those are in there as well. And we don't know what all the positives and negatives are associated with those extreme events. But one of the things that is important to Audubon and important to me is those ecological connections to some of the more mysterious and obscure components of our ecosystem. We've got this caterpillar. It's called the cypress looper caterpillar. And it's not that dynamic-looking a critter. It will come out some falls, it'll come out in mass and defoliate our cypress trees. And you might not give it a second thought, but it's critical for fueling the migration of our small warblers and other little passerine birds, you know, your buntings and your warblers and your red starts. So when they're making their way to Central and South America for the winter, they come down to Corkscrew, they feed on these cypress looper caterpillars, and they make it to their winter destination. But when you have a storm event like Irma that brings such strong winds in there, and they have an impact on those caterpillars and the pupa, and as a result of that, you have fewer caterpillars and cypress loopers around to feed those warblers, and there's an impact there on their migration. And we don't know about what those impacts are. We've lost so much of our old-growth cypress forest. We don't really have a handle on that. So when events like Irma arise, there are immediate, obvious, dramatic impacts, but then there are more subtle impacts that require a deeper understanding of how the ecosystem works and what those connections are to creatures that we know and care about. And for us, as a science-led environmental organization, these are important moments to sort of take stock of what we don't know and make sure in the future that we start monitoring and measuring those connections and elements of the ecosystem function so that we don't lose something that we care about out of ignorance.
That was WGCU's Mike Canary speaking with Jason Lauritsen. He is director of the Corkscrew Swamp Sanctuary in Collier County. We're going to take a quick break, but when we return, we're joined by a woman who teaches people how to watch others' homes for a living. She says Hurricane Irma has had a huge impact on her industry. I'm Julie Glenn, and you're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. One of the continuing issues people are facing is the long, painful wait for insurance money to come through a year after Hurricane Irma. Back in May, we talked with Chip Merlin. He's the founder and president of Merlin Law Group, and he focuses on commercial and residential property insurance claim disputes and bad faith insurance litigation. He said around April, his office started hearing from clients who were frustrated at the claim settlements their insurance companies were offering after Hurricane Irma. And in that conversation, he told us about a profession that I hadn't heard of before, that of the public adjuster. It's a licensed insurance adjuster that isn't the one sent by your insurance company. Here's a bit of that conversation.
If you have a lot of damage, and unless you're very good at valuation and things like that, which most people are not, I typically indicate that a public adjuster is a person that they should at least consider hiring. Now, public adjusters are licensed by the various states of the union, including Florida, and they are able to represent the policyholder with respect to making up estimates and valuation of what the total amount of the loss is.
So I've never heard of that.
They've been very helpful. Yeah, a lot of people have not. It's a fairly young industry. It did not exist significantly until after Hurricane Katrina, and then it really wasn't until the 2004 storms, when we had four hurricanes here in Florida, that the public insurance industry grew from something in the kin of a couple hundred people to in the heyday. Because remember, the following year we had two more storms, and there were over 2,000 public adjusters licensed by the state of Florida because of a change in requirements and continuing education and various apprentice programs that the state instituted. The number of public adjusters in the state of Florida is now, again, less than 1,000. But these individuals are trained. All they can do is represent policyholders with respect to evaluation and helping determine the rights and benefits they have under the insurance policy, and they deal with the insurance company. So if a person like myself is busy traveling all over the United States, I wouldn't have time to do my insurance claim. It's just not, something I could do.
It's a full-time job. Recommend.
Right.
It really is.
Until people actually have the claim, they don't know how time-consuming it is. And unfortunately, many people just give up. It's not that it's lazy. It just takes so much time to go through the tedium, to go through every little detail of an insurance claim, dealing with insurance adjusters, dealing with estimators and everybody else. I often indicate that sometimes a public adjuster is the best alternative for many individuals, especially when you have, a larger loss versus a smaller one.
That was part of a conversation we had with Chip Merlin. He's the founder and president of Merlin Law Group, which focuses on property insurance claim disputes. You can find that conversation in its entirety on our website at gulfcoastlive.org. One industry that has seen tremendous change in the time since Hurricane Irma is the home watch industry. It's a big part of life for Southwest Floridians, snowbirds, frequent vacationers, or in times of hurricanes, evacuees. Diane Pisani is the founder of Your Home Watch Professionals, an organization that trains people in home watch services. Diane, thanks for being on the show again. It's good to have you back.
Julie, it's great to be back.
If you're just joining the show today, we're talking about the impacts of Hurricane Irma on all aspects of living here in paradise. Do you have a story to share? You can give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Diane, it's been a year. How's it been? Tell me how this hurricane has been a game changer in the world of home watch.
Hurricane Irma single-handedly separated what I call the hobby home watchers from the home watch professionals. A lot of people start as neighbors doing favors, and they start a hobby home watch company, which means they're taking money for home watch. They usually don't have a contract. They usually don't have insurance, and they're oftentimes not even taking their business seriously. Hate to say it, but they bailed during the hurricane. The professionals were here to take care of their clients.
Okay, so it's kind of like the Wild West right now. I mean, is there any kind of regulation of home watch services?
At this point in time, and surprisingly so, especially in places like Florida and Arizona, no, none. You could start your company tomorrow, Julie, and start taking money from people. Nobody technically could stop you.
See, I would feel bad about that because I know I don't have time to go out and look at all these houses, but I'm sure there are a lot of people that don't have it, or they think they can handle it and they really can't.
Well, I say people think because they live in a home, they're qualified to watch somebody else's home. And that's like me saying because I watch Dancing with the Stars that I'm a good dancer.
Yeah, I'm not either. I hear you. Are there enough people that are actually trained to do home watch in our area?
Oh, never enough, never enough. I've been actually training for over 10 years now, and folks will often ask me if the home watch profession is saturated, and there's not a chance of that happening. We have thousands and thousands of seasonal homeowners here, and we chatted a little bit earlier about how many clients, you know, one home watch reporter could basically serve. There's some people out there that say they single-handedly have 75, 100, 1 or 200 clients for one person. Folks, that's way too much. In general, one reporter, about 30 to 50 clients or so, give or take.
So, yeah. So when you're hiring someone to do home watch for you, mm-hmm. and you say, oh, so how many homes do you take care of? And they say 100, and they work all by themselves. That's just not possible.
Run, Forrest, run.
Run, run, run.
Yep.
Okay, that's not your person. So you say how many? 30 to 50?
30 to 50 is a fair average, yes.
And even if the geography is concentrated, if it's all in one gated community, for example?
Then the number would go up. But, you know, we have to make a comprehensive visit, and that's what most people don't understand. I hear about home watchers that go in for 5 to 7 minutes for a visit.
Yeah. So what do you tell a home watcher that they have to do? I mean, you do the training. So you mm-hmm. tell them what they need to look at. How long does it take for someone to check a house?
Okay. Well, our job is to discover damage in the early stages before it becomes disaster and to be able to see any irregularities. If we see a baseboard that's pulled away a little bit from the wall, we know that's a sign of water damage. But we're also checking under every water source. We cycle the water. So technically, we flush toilets for a living, Julie.
Yeah, flush toilets.
But that's important because when we do, we're using our flashlight to look and see if there are any leaks. Likewise, when we're running water through the traps, we're looking for leaks. We're checking, especially this year, 1 year after Hurricane Irma, we have had so many roof leaks that didn't show up, you know, for months after. And just we had the storm last week. There's even more.
Yeah, we went through dry season.
Yeah.
And then we had the rain season. And that's when maybe some of them show up. But then after Tropical Storm Gordon came through, did you see a lot of stuff show up?
The gift that keeps on giving.
Yeah.
Got to tell you.
Well, you know, I was talking with Chip, the guy that we just had a little quote from. He was talking about how there are a lot of people and a lot of insurance adjusters that will not catch roof damage on the first go-round because you don't really know what's happened. You can't really see what's happened during those winds that kind of lift the roof up a little bit and set it right back down.
Oh, absolutely. And sometimes, you know, I mean, we had all that sideways rain during the hurricane, too. There could be water leaking for a very, very long time before it's noticeable to the eye.
Or the nose.
Oh, if it's noticeable to the nose, you're in deep trouble.
Yeah, I know. I've been there. You've been in that deep trouble. It's been real fun digging my way out. But I wanted to ask, did you have any stories after Hurricane Irma of neighbors doing favors that were kind of disastrous?
Well, and even some of the home watchers are hobby home watchers, too, because the key to working with a home watch company is working with somebody who's prepared. We work diligently every year. Our clients who have to have the storm panels put up, we get contractors arranged with them, you know, between the client and the contractor ahead of time. So when the storm comes, we go into action. People were ill prepared. And one of the glaring things was after like a week after the storm, I'm looking on Facebook and you've got these home watch people coming back. And it's like, oh, I just returned from evacuating. I'm cleaning out all this rotten food from my clients' refrigerators. This is such hard work. And they're thinking they're the hero. And I just rolled my eyes because a real home watch professional did not have one morsel of food in that refrigerator. Every single one was cleaned out ahead of time. So that's proof that people don't know what they don't know if they're not professionally trained.
So if you're a home watcher, for example, and you have a snowbird that's gone and you have a hurricane coming, mm-hmm. your job as a home watch person is to go in there and get all that stuff out of the freezer?
Absolutely. I mean, we try to have them do it anyway at the beginning of season because we still have so many power outages, but you get a little bit lax on the rules. Absolutely. Not one morsel of food in any of our fridges. And that in itself saved the insurance companies a ton of money in claims.
Yeah, because it can kind of gross out your
refrigerator. Oh, if you have shrimp or chicken, imagine that after 7 or 8 days.
Yeah, that doesn't go.
That's
a gift that keeps on giving, that's for sure. So I wanted to ask, how has technology kind of bolstered the accountability of home watch services? I mean, how do you know they're doing what they're doing?
Or even if they're showing up. Because I can remember sometimes folks are looking for new home watch companies. It's like, you know, Diane, I think I better get a new one because my home watcher fills out a piece of paper when he comes. And I came back to my condo and he filled it out 6 weeks in advance. So accountability has always been a huge thing. We utilize proprietary software that is GPS enabled. So each of our homeowners has a very customized checklist. We can't even open the checklist until we're physically there. So I can't sit at Starbucks and pretend I'm making my home watch visits.
Oh, okay.
Which is huge to the homeowner.
Yeah, that's really some serious accountability.
And they have access to their report the entire time.
This sounds like such a great business to get in. I can't believe that it isn't. There aren't too many people doing this.
Never too many.
Yeah. I mean,
never too many.
I would
or more.
Think that would be flooded.
Or more doing, or more. We shouldn't say the word flooded in home
yeah,
watch.
Yeah, sorry. That's a bad word.
Be careful with that. No, it's, you know what, I will tell you, 10 plus years ago, or about 10 years ago, I was training mostly baby boomers because home watch seemed to be appealing to folks that are doing, you know, a home watch company post retirement. Not anymore. I'm getting millennials. I'm getting people in their 20s and 30s. I'm getting husbands and wives. We are progressively turning us into a true profession. And incidentally, it's probably one of the highest paid professions in Lee and Collier County.
And I'm wondering, how much does a home watch service go for? I mean, how many times do you need someone to check your house?
Okay.
And then how much are you probably going to be looking at paying for that?
Okay. Happy to help you with that. Number one, the biggest no-no is, I still see companies out there, and it boggles my mind also, offering a one-time per month visit. That's just every kind of silliness. So if your home watch company offers that, again, run for the hills there. Once a month gives our homeowners a false sense of security. It's not a good business practice. And there's language in the insurance policies now. So every homeowner, if there's any takeaway from this, look at your policy, call your agent, see what it calls for frequency of visits, and those have to be documented. So I've got, you know, one story too. A gal was a neighbor doing a favor. For all means and purposes, a good job. Water damage happened. She caught it. It got taken care of. The insurance adjuster asked the homeowner, do you have somebody looking after your home? And she said, yeah, my friend's doing it. It's like, well, prove it. Well, she was calling after every single visit instead of putting it in writing.
So she had to get her phone logs or something, I guess. Well, that didn't work?
No, it had to be in writing. So either software or an email. Claim denied, over $15,000. Claim denied, friendship ruined. Home watch is a real business. We go in general either weekly, biweekly, at the very least three times per month. The going rate for home watch, a start out rate for like a three bedroom, two bathroom, anywhere between $45 to $50 per visit.
Okay.
And then up from there for your larger homes, of course. So even on a small home where there are good 20, 25 minutes, 40 minutes.
Okay. So as someone who travels for maybe like a week or so at a time during rainy season, can you give us like a little pro tip for what kind of things you need to look at when you first get back into your house?
Well, a good thing to do too when you leave is to turn off your water at the water main, because a line can break at any time. So you could come back to a flood, a toilet line can break or something like that. Make sure you take the proper action with your water heater. Many times they have to be turned off also. Upon return, just look for anything out of sorts. You know, so many people come back and they walk into a puddle of water or water gushing out of their garage.
And check those baseboards
for
sure. So
preventative measures are what's good.
All right. Well, that's all the time we've got for today. I want to thank my guest, Diane Pisani, founder of Your Home Watch Professionals. Thanks again for coming back in.
Always. Thank you.
Our show today was produced by Mike Canary, Rachel Iacovone, and myself. Our director is Richard Chin Kui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers, 90.1, WMKO Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida. And before we sign off today, we're going to listen back to a collection of sound clips we assembled of our Hurricane Irma coverage. You're going to hear the voices of John Davis, Rachel Iacovone, and myself, as well as Jessica Mazaros and Quincy Walters, both of whom are no longer with WGCU. This coverage earned national recognition for coverage of breaking news, winning a national Edward R. Murrow Award, which we will go to New York to receive later this month. It's been quite a year of repairs, community, and recovery, and it started like this.
From WGCU News, I'm John Davis. A mandatory evacuation order has been issued for portions of Sarasota County, including low-lying areas, barrier islands, and mobile homes. That includes Longboat Keys.
The hurricane watch has been upgraded to a hurricane warning for coastal Charlotte, coastal Lee, coastal Sarasota, DeSoto, Hardy, Highlands, inland Charlotte, inland Lee, inland Manatee, and inland Sarasota.
Local emergency managers just completed a news conference at the Lee County Emergency Operations Center just moments ago with the latest on preparations for Hurricane Irma. WGCU's Quincy Walters was there.
The Lee County manager, Roger Desjardins, said this storm is unprecedented, and he said to expect a lot of property damage in Lee County when this is over, and he said...
WGCU's Rachel Iacovone is in the Collier County Emergency Operations Center, where authorities are monitoring the storm. She spoke with WGCU's Julie Glenn just moments ago.
So, Rachel, what's happening where you are?
So right now, it's a pretty fluid situation. They're trying to figure out where to open some new shelters. There was a list of 6 or 7 that have just been canceled as of 30 seconds ago. The storm surge predictions were off, so they're thinking that I'm at the EOC in Collier, and it's right next to Laley Elementary School, which is supposed to be a shelter. And you can see the line of cars from here, and people are being turned away, and they have to turn around and find another shelter, but many are at capacity.
From WGCU News, I'm Jessica Mazaros. As Hurricane Irma gets closer to Florida, a press conference was held at the Lee County Emergency Operations Center this morning. County Manager Roger Desjarlais opened the press conference by expressing the magnitude of this hurricane.
This storm is unprecedented. There's going to be a lot of property damage in Lee County when this thing is over.
Desjarlais says that Lee County has
the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's website says if you are hunkered down in your home during a hurricane, make sure to do the following. Take refuge in a small interior room, closet, or hallway on the lowest level during the storm. Put as many walls between you and the outside as you can. Maybe cover yourself with cushions or pillows. Stay away from
the Collier County Emergency Operations Center says the shelter at Temple Shalom in Naples has reached capacity as of 5 minutes ago. There's a nearby shelter at Gulf Coast High School in North Naples that is open. The school has another 450 seats available in its auditorium. Since they are literal seats, the county advises those going to Gulf Coast High to leave behind the cots and mattresses.
Crews are shutting down their work around South Florida, and FPL's Juliet Rulak says that it's getting too dangerous for repairs.
It continues to worsen. We're not going to be able to have our crews out there. We need to get them to safety so they can be rested and available to immediately respond post-storm.
FPL says crews won't be able to restore power in any area that has winds above 35 miles per hour. Lee County residents were still evacuating their homes early this morning and finding safety from Hurricane Irma in local shelters. Douglas Lopez Perez, originally from Guatemala, evacuated his home in Bonita Springs to the Germain Arena in Estero.
Como vemos pues que ya se nos acerca la tormenta grande y solo Dios con nosotros.
He says that the major storm is getting close enough now that only God is with us. This has been continuing coverage during Hurricane Irma from WGCU.
This is WGCU News. I'm Julie Glenn. We have confirmed tropical storm force winds in Collier County, and we will be with you now nonstop on the air with additional support from the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network, which will bring us the latest information on the storm's movements from their teams of meteorologists. We have reporters stationed at the Collier and Lee County Emergency Operations Centers. They've been there since yesterday. First, let's check in with WGCU's Rachel Iacovone, who is in Collier County. Rachel, what's it like right now?
Hi, Julie. I'm looking out the window right now at the Collier Emergency Operations Center, and the palm trees are bending. The wind is picking up, and the rain is like bullets. They're advising us not to go outside. Some of the TV reporters have been stepping out for live shots, and that is no longer an option.
No longer an option because that wind is really whipping up, and it's kind of unpredictable.
Oh, absolutely. There are projectiles, there's palm fronds flying everywhere. It's just not safe anymore.
Have they given you any indication as to how fast these winds are blowing at this point?
Yeah, some of the staff members have been saying that they are registering at 115 miles per hour now here.
115 miles per hour. Okay, and you were able to capture some sound so we can hear what that sounds like. Let's have a listen to that now. How does that feel when you're hearing that?
Well, it's just crazy because we're all locked in this media room and, you know, we're all pressed against these windows and then the sound began. And that was 2 hours ago, just when it was the tropical storm force wind. So right now it's even louder.
Now let's go to WGCU's Jessica Mazaros, who talked with our chief engineer about the status of our Marco Island transmitter, where there are many without power, possibly relying on our broadcast for updates.
From WGCU News, I'm Jessica Mazaros. I'm here with WGCU's chief engineer, Kevin Trueblood. He has some important information regarding our transmitter on Marco Island, which is 91.7 FM. Hey, Kevin, what's going on in light of Hurricane Irma's approach to Southwest Florida?
Well, we're seeing some of that storm surge really impacting Southern Collier County.
Rachel Iacovone, who is down in Collier County, where we are told that the eye is currently about to pass. Rachel, can you feel anything different?
Hey, Julie. Yeah, so right now I'm looking at the parking lot filled with water and trees are falling everywhere, but things are actually slowing down a little bit. As you're saying, the eye is approaching and you can tell. We just went through the eye wall, which was like the strongest band that we have had yet. And now the palm trees are not bending as much and there's not any fronds falling over. The pines already fallen, most of them.
And where you're at is the Lely Resort area, correct?
Yes, so this place had been evacuated because of the flood risk. Right now I'm looking at probably 6 inches of water in the lot, and we have this pond that's formed, and right now I'm watching the water collect. It is drying up, and it seems like the sun is coming up, so we are coming to the eye right now.
Oh, the eye is passing right now.
Yep.
How weird is it to see sun coming through after such a violent storm like that? Does it give you a better view of what's happened outside?
Yeah, the windows are starting to fog up because we're getting some of that heat. Like I said, it's been kind of cold. And so this kind of a pressure change, a temperature change I'm seeing right now, and definitely a brightness change. We were all talking about how it's been odd all day, how bright it's been despite all the wind and the rain. But now as we've gotten into the center of the hurricane and more of that, you know, eye wall, it's been dark. It's been like we have been inside a tornado for a while now. And here it is suddenly brightened up. It's like a light gray outside, and you would think we're in a spring storm.
Like a summer storm just went through. It's kind of like you forgot what Florida sunshine was during all of that.
Right.
Well, it's been really interesting talking with you, Rachel. I really appreciate the first-person update on what it feels like when that eye goes over. Thank you so much for that report.
To get the job done to make sure Lee County's up and running again as soon as possible.
Thank you for all you're doing and all your department's doing to help keep us safe.
No problem. Have a great day.
You too.
That was Lee County Sheriff's Office Lieutenant James Drizmala speaking with WGCU's John Davis this afternoon. As massive Hurricane Irma batters Florida on a path up the Gulf Coast, Governor Rick Scott today advised residents against rushing out.